Good evening and welcome to Radio Edutalk. My name is David Noble and Dalgetty Bay in Scotland, and this evening I'm delighted to welcome to the show Neil Dempsey, who's over in Ireland and he's going to be talking about his master's research on the path from primary to third level education for students with dyslexia. Good evening Neil and welcome to Edutalk.
Hello David, thank you.
If you're listening to the live show, you might want to head over to the homepage, edutalk.cc, where you'll see near the top of the page a link to Neil's master dissertation that you could download and maybe have a browse through as you're listening to the show. And if you're listening to the podcast, just underneath the play button will also be a link to open up Neil's master's dissertation. And thank you so much for sharing your work. I know that it's not always easy to get permission to share dissertations. Neil, just to start off with, could you give us an idea about who you are and where you're from and what you do?
Okay, well, I spent 36 years as a second level teacher in Ireland. And for about 25 years of those, I worked with kids with special needs of all sorts, from dyslexia on. And so I came to do my master's in educational psychology quite late in life, after retiring early from teaching. Yeah, it's something that I wanted to do for a long time. So I took early retirement and I did over here. It's still possible to become an educational psychologist by doing a master's in educational psychology, whereas over in the UK, it's a PhD and it's going that way now. So I did this research as part of my master's. And the reason I was interested in it was when I was a teacher, dyslexia, the kind of conversations, the way in which it was seen as a kind of a cap to people's educational aspirations. Kids, when they were told they were dyslexic, really didn't see themselves as academic. And their education, particularly being in school, was, I found, frequently a source of frustration, so that they welcomed the idea of not having to do it anymore. And you can understand that because reading is really important to learning. But then when I quit teaching and I was working as a psychologist in student support in a third level institution, I met students there who had quite severe dyslexia. And I really found this puzzling for two reasons. First of all, why would they want to do that? And secondly, how did they manage to achieve that? And so that's what brought me to do this research.
Okay, fascinating stuff. And maybe at the very top of the show then, Neil, could you just give us an idea about, I suppose, the various definitions of dyslexia that you've come across and indeed you've referred to in your paper?
Yeah, well, I ran the Rose report, which defined dyslexia as a learning difficulty that affects the skills involved in accurate and fluent word reading and spelling, and that occurs across all intellectual abilities and is best seen as a continuum. But I'm kind of keeping in mind as well the argument that broke out with the publication of the dyslexia debate back in April by Elliot and, I think I'm pronouncing the name right, Grigorenko, where they argued against the construct of dyslexia because they said there's no such thing. It lacks coherence. There's no one particular set. It's something like a medical concept. Whereas when we use the word dyslexia, it implies we're dealing with a specific medical syndrome, and they argue that we should abolish it because it's lazy and it doesn't do any good at all. I kept that in mind when I was doing it, but I'm also conscious, I think Darcy Bishop who argued that, yes, all of that is true, but it's actually still very useful to have a name. It helps people realize that the difficulties have been taken seriously, and I just think we need to be a little bit conscious and careful of how we use it. We need to be consistent and we need to be meaningful rather than just abolish it completely.
And I'm just wondering... Sorry, I was just going to ask Neil, but are there common features among each of the definitions? Is there agreement around, for example, the idea of it being difficult to process speech sounds, to organise, to focus, to sequence?
That's right. It's basically mostly it affects the skills involved in fluent word reading and spelling. There are three possible explanations or models put forward for us. One is that somebody who has dyslexia has a difficulty with their phonological skills. They have a problem with phonological awareness. They can't manipulate the sounds of a language. They can't remember sounds. They can't sequence them. And as a result, they can't process speech sounds accurately. So their reading becomes very slow and inaccurate and all the rest of it. There's another model which says it's got to do with working memory. And this is a little bit more complicated. I don't want to go into the details of the concept of working memory and all the rest of it, but the idea is there's three components to it, and the different ways in which dyslexia can affect somebody can relate to difficulties in specific areas. And the third one has to do with phonological deficits and something called rapid automatized naming. And the most serious dyslexic difficulties are for those people who have difficulties in both phonological deficits and RAN. So really, it's to do with word retrieval, pronunciation, verbal naming, phonological awareness. It's all over the place, really, and that's one of the difficulties about it, and that's one of the reasons why it's criticized, because there is no one thing that is dyslexia. It's a huge spectrum of abilities. It's a continuum more than anything else.
And, you know, you're talking here about how among the experts it's a contested area, but I know that you referenced some works, and indeed I think you can read into it in your own research that people with dyslexia themselves also appear to categorise themselves in different ways.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, it's something that I didn't really go into in to a great extent, because it's such a varied concept that the very fact that somebody has dyslexia doesn't mean that they've got anything in common with somebody else who has dyslexia. And it was one of the difficulties that I had when I was choosing participants for the research, in that some people would have suggested that they take part in, but their perception of what constituted dyslexia would not have seen them in any way impaired in secondary school or in third level education. And I felt that I needed to be quite strict about choosing participants. So I only picked people who had a formal diagnosis of dyslexia by an educational psychologist and who had received what we call over here, I'm sure you have in the UK as well, reasonable accommodations to even the playing pitch, such as extra time, the use of a scribe, perhaps the use of a laptop, spelling and grammar waivers, somebody to read the paper. I felt that if somebody was granted those by the State Exams Commission in Ireland, that meant that they had reached a cut-off point. And beyond that, I could be certain that these people would have had difficulties in learning. Whereas there are those who have, as it were, dyslexic symptoms, but they actually haven't got a huge difficulty with learning. They can still manage quite well.
And just moving on to your actual research then, Neil, you just talked through your methods and your methodology. I understand this was, am I right in saying, a thematic analysis of transcriptions from a small number of interviews?
I wanted to examine the lived experience and the views of people who had dyslexia, who had progressed successfully through first, second, and then third level education. And the best way I felt to do that was conducting semi-structured interviews, which I then analysed thematically in order to try and discover what they had got in common. And hopefully I would shed light on, well, one of the I had four basic questions. I wanted to find out what was the effect of being told that you were dyslexic when you were in primary, second level, or third level. I specifically wanted to look at the emotional effects of that. I also wanted to find out from them what were those factors that assisted them in overcoming the dyslexia so they could succeed through second and third level. What was it in their schooling and their lives that made them able to have and to keep academic aspirations, that they actually wanted to go to third level. Because most of the people that I had taught over the years who had dyslexic, there was no way they would have chosen third level education. As soon as they were finished with us, they were gone, and that was that. And I also was interested to find out what were the implications of the dyslexia now that they had finished their third level education. What difference did it make to their lives? Did it make any difference? So that was the methods that I used. Now, I wasn't able to get, I had to be choosy about, I wanted third level graduates specifically, but I couldn't get enough of those, so I had to compromise a little bit. Those who were progressing successfully, two of the people were progressing successfully. But on the other hand, some of the other participants had two master's degrees behind them, under the belt. I was very specific about wanting a formal diagnosis. I mentioned already accommodations and state examinations. And all in all, just 8 participants fulfilled all those criteria. So I was in the position to run with those. So that was that.
Yeah, and so you then, through your thematic analysis, you then came up with 5 different themes relating to the particular research question.
That's right. There were 5 themes that emerged from the interviews. Will I go through them one at a time?
Yes, please, Neil. Thanks.
Okay. I was the first one. I was particularly intrigued by the effects of the consequences of being told that somebody was actually dyslexic. And on the whole, the participants were happy to have been told that. They felt relieved to have been told that, there was actually a name for the difficulties that they had, that they knew. One particular girl said, I wasn't a stupid child. It was a validation of something that they were already aware of. And in that sense, it was liberating. And this is relating to the labelling debate, the reluctance that we have of perhaps saying, do we want to give somebody the label of being dyslexic? None of the participants saw it as a label. They saw it as a validation. And they did mention, however, that being told that they were on its own wasn't sufficient, that what really made a difference to them were the strategies or the recommendations that they were given for helping them to move forward. They didn't want to just told, you're dyslexic. They want to know what you can do to sort this problem out. And one of the participants mentioned self-belief. And she felt that fostering self-belief is more vital than diagnosing dyslexia or giving strategies. That the most corrosive part of having dyslexia is the fact that you lose belief in yourself. You lose the confidence that you can actually learn. The second theme that emerged from the interviews were the fact that all of the participants felt that they could not live in isolation as a dyslexic. And all of them mentioned the importance of family. And this resonated because a previous, I think his name was Palikara, in 2006, mentioned that the family could be a moderating influence. Here they mentioned that families gave them emotional resilience, that they had the confidence of the parents. Parents told them they weren't stupid. Family background as well, and this is something that has other resonances as well. Perhaps we'll get to that later. The very fact that families valued education in itself was a reason for them wanting to achieve. One particular participant mentioned that everyone in her family had gone to university. What else was she going to do? So it was a natural progression. There was also the fact that families facilitated in a very practical way, like they paid for extra tuition, they paid for advice, they paid for support. And like it was in a very practical sense, families were instrumental. That was one of the things that really came out of the study, is that it was really, really important that family background could bolster somebody against the difficulties and the erosion that happens to somebody's self-esteem and self-concept through having dyslexia. There were other support structures mentioned, such as the Dyslexia Association, obviously, private lessons. There was a second level, and I don't know does this apply in the UK as well, but certainly in Ireland, second level didn't come out well of this. Primary level education came out very well. They talked about getting lots of support there, and third level came out extremely well. But second level was seen as a battle, having a huge impact on self-esteem. And one participant even said that having finished the second level education, they were just drained. I'll come back to that later. The third theme was the extent to which they saw themselves responsible for their own success in learning. Some were surprised by doing well. They thought, oh, this is just a fluke. And in some sense, that harks back to the Berosus attributional style that comes with dyslexia, that you're inclined to think that if you do well, it's just lucky, and if you do badly, that's because I'm stupid. Others were impatient with the negative way in which dyslexia is thought about and talked about. They really resented, you know, that they knew they were and they resented the way in which dyslexia was seen as a barrier to moving on. A fourth theme were the ways in which they survived in school, by concealing their dyslexia, by compensating for it. Some of them were really good at cheating, experts at it, and had really, really good tricks that got them through school. Strategic absences were utilized, strategic latencies. One particular participant spoke about volunteering very, very frequently. The hand was always up for anything that was non-academic in the hopes that she wouldn't be noticed when it came to volunteering for academic things, and it worked for her. They also mentioned the school choices that they made, the subjects that they chose to study, and the choices in later life. It was significant in that sense that none of them opted to study liberal arts in college. Most of them were in art and design or technology, and some in construction or management, but there were no liberal arts people there. And the last one was about the way in which they saw third level education. On the one hand, it was a liberation, and on the other hand, it was very challenging to them. They liked because they had alternative ways of communicating the knowledge that they had. Universities or third level institutions did not demand essay form responses all the time. Diagrams were okay, notes were okay. There was less pedantry, and the word pedantry was actually used by one of them. Like second level schools are kind of obsessed with spelling, with neatness of work and all the rest of it, whereas in university that wasn't the case. They simply were interested in, did you understand, did you know? They found the work more practical and engaging, but obviously that would be the case because they would have chosen the subjects that suited themselves. And also, third level were more open to providing assistance for them. They felt that second level education was very organizationally complex. A lot of people in a lot of places, some teachers, it's a huge organizational, strategic job. And that militated against supporting them. And that is because the Rose findings as well, which suggested that second level school comes quite short in providing support. But we also said that work at third level was challenging. Some mentioned like arrangements that were made for examinations whereby extra time was granted. That was fine, it helped a lot. But they found they had huge problems in preparing for the exams because reading was slow, note-taking was slow, and these are things that can't be compensated for examinations.
So I've just you've covered so much and so many of the questions that I was going to ask. I'm just maybe go straight into it then. In terms of actual strategies then for families and for education staff, there was a few things that I kind of picked out from your paper. One of the participants in the research spoke about recording notes and then playing them back and such like. There seemed to be some suggestion. I think there was a mother or a family member reading between the lines. It was continued paired reading or one to one reading, and then the use of mind maps. But I'm just wondering, are these and other strategies useful for us all to know about, or to go back to your earlier point about the context, the difficulties faced by each person with dyslexia can be very different?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because families that knew a lot about education. And the particular participant that you're talking about there, the family were very much involved in the world of education and would have been familiar with how to cope with coping strategies and had the resources to be useful. That wouldn't necessarily be the case in everybody's family, you know. So it does beg the question as to whether or not... you know, it's family that decides whether you go to third level or whether, you know, it's your academic ability. They used mind mapping, for example. All of these skills that are used, like taping classes, playing back things, this kind of stuff. All of those skills should really are passed on at second level to students, but obviously they're not taken up by everybody. So. It's something that I felt perhaps suggests that family role is even more important for those people who are dyslexic than it would ordinarily be, because these people need help more than your average student. They need that support.
Yeah, and you've mentioned about the struggles, I suppose, through second level. You know, to me it seemed... as if in fact, you mentioned in some of your literature review about there being some evidence about high levels of anxiety and stress in people with dyslexia. And it just seems like that possibly for many that their whole experience, particularly in second level, is about continual strategies to kind of work around or maybe even to avoid certain learning situations that you talk about, you write about the invisibility has been a blessing as a curse, a blessing and a curse, and this continual need to play to strengths, and the fact that second level education very often doesn't allow you the choice to play to your strengths, and maybe that's the blessing that comes with third level. So again, possibly reading between the lines, it's a kind of damning indictment of aspects of second level education.
It is, and I mean, having been a second level teacher for 36 years, it didn't make pleasant listening to this. But these were valid comments that were made by people who had been through the system, and I can see how it would have happened, because organising a second level school is a very complicated job. There's lots of students, there are lots of teachers. The timetable is God, and it's very, very difficult to try and facilitate individual needs within that. Now, so schools do, but it's a mixed garden. I mean, some people would have much better experiences than others, but it's interesting that all of the participants here mentioned that second level school was the one level that they felt most difficult. And I think that might have to do with the fact that reading is very important, massively important. The timetable, they're doing subjects that they probably don't want to do, aren't very good at. And as well as that, I got the feeling from listening to them that these people that spoke to me were quite obviously very intelligent people, but only in the areas they really weren't patient about things that they just wanted to move on and do things that they could do well. They didn't want to waste their time on things that they knew they were struggling with. And I think there was a certain amount of resentment about that. I'm perhaps reading into it too much there, but I really feel that for them, when they moved to third level, it was a liberation and they didn't have to study subjects that they found difficult.
I appreciate that we don't want to read too much into to, you know, it's a fascinating piece of research, but I just wonder if there may then be an argument to for reading to be less of a feature of the education process at second level, and you know, maybe bringing in, I don't know, possibly more multimedia, as well as you're kind of mentioning at the third level that the actual assessed pieces of work could often be something other than an essay that maybe was a feature at second level.
Yeah, I just don't know how possible that is given the organizational nature of second level schools, but I understand exactly where they were coming from. It's just the nature of the beast, I suppose, that it's not very friendly for individual needs. You know, it's quite difficult. But having said that, I mean, I know from the other side that a lot of effort does go into trying to compensate difficulties for difficulties, individual difficulties, but obviously it's not as successful as we'd like it to be.
And you know, repeatedly it seems like the compensating for these difficulties, as you say, is based around asking for help from professionals and from family members, and you know, yes, that builds up the self-belief. But you also, forgive me if I've missed this out somewhere, but you also mentioned the importance of, or the possible importance of metacognitive strategies. And I'm just wondering if you can elaborate a little bit more on what they might be.
Yeah, it was one thing that was identified as being crucially important in the educational trajectory of adults in particular. The idea of thinking about how you think. Instead of metacognitive strategies would specifically that children would be conscious of the way in which they learn, what's working and what isn't working. I can recall talking to one particular student who was having difficulties with spelling, and I asked her, well, how do you normally learn how to spell a word? And she described, you know, she would write it over and over and over, maybe 10 times. And I said, does that work? And she said, no. So, but she still did it. And like metacognitive strategies would suggest that she might be better off if she actually put some thought into it and decided, well, that doesn't work, I'll try something else. Thinking about the way in which she thought she learned, that would have been one of the strategies, I think, that a lot of them, like with no exceptions, the participants in this study, and there were only 8, so it has limited applicability to other people, but perhaps their experience would resonate with other people. They were very well up. They had thought a lot about themselves, about the difficulties that they were having, and they took on the third level courses that they took on, having thought about what they found difficult and having accepted that and having, you know, and took it on and got there despite it. Oddly enough, one of the things that came out of talking to them was that the subjective nature of what success is. Some of them didn't actually see themselves as being successful at all. They were conscious of the fact of the difficulties, of the fact that they had managed to achieve a third level degree, sometimes a higher level degree, but I did not see that they were particularly successful. Just concentrated on the difficulties they had. So I don't know, does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm also wondering just about how things could be reformed within the second level. You know, you've got kind of 8 broad curricular areas in Scotland, and you know, young people would be working through these various levels within the curricular areas up until you know, around the end of third year. Until it roughly, you know, 14, 15 years old. But from what your participants are saying and how you've kind of drawn that together into themes, you know, there seems to be an argument possibly for letting young people, maybe particularly young people with an additional support need such as dyslexia, to specialise or to choose subjects or to choose to drop certain subjects at an earlier age. And one other reason why that might actually be a good thing would be to give them more time and space to work at their own speed through the particular curricular areas that they find that they're actually getting somewhere with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yeah, I imagine some of the difficulties would be the age group, that all of the participants in my study were adults between the ages of 1 and I think the eldest was 50. So when they were talking about education, like, I don't know they have been as forthcoming when they were perhaps 14 or 15. So I don't know how well their ideas would translate into actual action.
Of course, yeah.
You know, for kids, because kids are kids. So it's interesting listening to them. I really feel that what I think is needed is a more longitudinal approach to it. It would be really interesting to follow some people, say, from the time they are diagnosed with dyslexia, perhaps in primary school, the whole way through second level and right as far as they go, and monitor their progress, talk to them, find out what's the study now, but approach to find out what it was like being dyslexic and passing through education. And I think that would give us, certainly it would give strategies, because one of the things that I noticed particularly, and I notice now working as a psychologist with children, is that if you're telling, you know, you've got something like dyslexia, what can we do about it? Is this the end of education? Can you suggest strategies? And it's nice to be able to say, well, okay, try this, try that, try the other. To throw a lot of responsibility on top of the individual and the individual's family and say, well, okay, you're going to have difficulties, and this is what they're going to be, so let's look at how you can overcome them. And because the participants themselves mentioned that the strategies they found the most useful part of us, and they used them. But you see, one of the flaws of the study is that all of the participants were successful. None of them failed, as it were. They all managed to get some sort of level of education. I wonder if a different story would be told by those who hadn't managed to succeed in getting to second and third level. So it's interesting to hear what they have to say. I think there's a lot more to be said about it than my research can offer.
I'm also wondering, Neil, when you're mentioning about the benefits of networks, both family and out with the family, and extra tuition and such like, and kind of knowing the codes and knowing how the education system works, whether there might be a kind of class or race or gender.
Yes. I think there is. I think without the old kind of phrase that dyslexia class disease, I mean, obviously that's rubbish, but the truth of the matter is that somebody who comes from a family for whom education is valued, who actually knows how the system works and knows how to help and has resources, financial or time or emotional resources, and believes it's important to do it, stands a far better chance of overcoming their dyslexia. Now, that's not particularly that's not what I was researching into, but it is significant that all of the participants mentioned the family support as being significant. And I just wonder, would that have been the case for those who, for whom third level education and second level education was not successful?
Yeah, and just finally, Neil, I know we're just coming to the end of the show, and I suppose in the last couple of minutes, if any listeners wish to get in touch with any comments or questions for Neil, you can get in touch in the usual two ways. You can email edutalk@hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, you can pop something up with the hashtag edutalk, and even if you're listening to the podcast, I'll make sure I pass any comments or questions on to Neil after the show. Just finally, from myself, the literature seems to I agree that dyslexia is lifelong, and you also, I don't think we've really touched on this, but your participants, many of them were quite clear that there was still fear and frustration at the third level,
Oh, yeah.
There's these difficulties and the need to compensate or mask or what have you these difficulties, is that they see that this is going to be a continuing battle into the workplace and to further study.
Yes, it is, and they mentioned that even still, in terms of coping with dyslexia, one of them actually said that when you're dyslexic, you don't work or live alone. That they need to use colleagues to facilitate. Like they need to use software for start for spelling. That kind of stuff. One or two of the people who worked in management positions would have used colleagues. So they needed their colleagues to be aware of their difficulties. One particular participant felt that in one or two positions that he was in, that he felt it necessary to conceal the fact that he was dyslexic because it wouldn't be understood or appreciated. So the battle continues after third level education. It's a lifelong I don't like using the word condition because that makes it sound like a medical condition, but it's a lifelong struggle, if you follow me. It's not necessarily finished when, like, they don't emerge from third level education and it's no longer a problem. They need support. All of the participants said they needed support after education as well in the work, and
For people to find out more information, you've mentioned the Dyslexia Association. I think that's the Dyslexia Association of Ireland. So where would is that? I would imagine that would be easy enough to find out more information online. Yeah. But in terms of the could you maybe pick out a couple of kind of key texts that, for yourself during your research and where else we might go to find out information?
Yeah, I found there were a couple of texts that I found particularly useful when I was doing the background research to this. One in particular, there's a guy called Polly Carr. That's Pollock. His name is Pollock. And he did a study of, call it Dyslexia, the Self and Higher Education, in which he looked at the learning life histories of students identified as dyslexic. And that was done about 9 years ago. That was really interesting. And then also there were a couple of papers that I found particularly useful. There's one by Nalavany, Caravan and Rennick. This done 4 years ago and talked about the psychosocial experiences associated with confirmed and self-identified dyslexia. And those two in particular I found really, really useful. There was another guy called Burden, and he did an article in 2008 asking, is dyslexia necessarily associated with negative feelings of self-worth? That was published by Wiley into Science, and that's particularly useful. I actually sent them on in a Word document to the program, so I don't know if you're able to put them in Dropbox.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll put them up in the show
notes.
But
I found those three papers particularly interesting in the context of this research.
Neil, thank you so much for giving up your valuable time this evening to join us on Radio EduTalk. It's been really fascinating listening to it, and hopefully we'll get some comments from listeners once the podcast goes up online. So thank you very much again, and best wishes for the future.
Thanks, David. Thank you. Bye-bye.